From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The 108th Congress has just begun, and the change in party leadership could have serious consequences for regulating media. Maybe. On the Senate side, the chairman of the Commerce Committee that oversees a lot of these issues has moved from Fritz Hollings to the unpredictable but always interesting Arizona Republican John McCain. Alicia Mundy is senior editor for Cable World magazine, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, in a recent article, you made a glancing reference to McCain's, shall we say, distractibility. Is it possible to tell yet what his chief priorities will be in this area?
Well, those of us who have covered him on media issues over the years, we've always been fascinated by what seems to be attention deficit syndrome on McCain's part. One week he's sort of screaming about media consolidation, and the next week he's saying, let's remove all the regulations and let two companies buy everything in sight. But I think he will get rid of the regulation banning a broadcast station in one town from also owning a newspaper in that same town. Now, the trouble is, Hollings was very much against removing that. He was very concerned about the power of one media mogul to co-opt an entire market. I think this has been something the Democrats have been terrified will happen. Nonetheless, the Democrats aren't in power anymore, and I think this rule is going to go down, and you're going to just see a lot of ownership of both newspapers and broadcast stations in the same cities resulting.
And so on the issue of newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, McCain would seem to stand mostly with his Republican colleagues. Are there any of his positions that would pull against that majority?
I think he disagrees with a number of his colleagues on the issue of the network ownership cap. In the past, he said, let's let an individual network own so many stations that they can reach more than 35% of the American audience. He has said that he was in favor of raising that rule in the past. I think now he's become very concerned about the effects of what he sees in media consolidation. McCain really no longer wants to see the networks get the kind of cap raise that they'd like. They'd like the cap removed entirely or pushed up to 50%.
Let's talk about McCain's support or lack thereof in the committee and in the Senate in general. You've noted that at least a couple of McCain's Republican colleagues might not be all that eager to lend a hand.
Whenever he starts talking like a populist, he sounds just like one of the Democrats, and you think he would be right up there with Fritz Hollings. He doesn't sound like a Republican as often as he needs to, and so he's got Trent Lott, who's never liked McCain. You've got Ted Stevens from Alaska, who has been sitting on that committee for years with McCain, but does not vote in sync with him and is not a big fan of his. So it's going to be a very, very weird session of Congress.
It struck me that some of the most prominent Democrats, like presidential hopeful Joe Lieberman, seem to be much more hopped up on the issue of TV sex and violence. They're more concerned about content than conglomeration.
Well, this is the big issue that I think is going to take root, and it could have an impact on the whole issue of how much deregulation and how much media consolidation do you want. Commissioner Michael Copps, who's Democrat on the FCC, has been pushing for quite a while that there is a connection between the amount of media consolidation and the amount of what he would consider indecent sex and violence on the air, both on radio and television. And you have strange bedfellows making even stranger politics here, with the very conservative Republicans joining the very liberal Democrats and saying, we have got to start cleaning up the airwaves. And this is a very important issue because the networks, in terms of viewers, are taking it on the chin. They're losing viewers to cable because cable has more sex and more violence. And they're trying to copy the cable TV shows at a time when people in Congress are going, oh my God, how can we make the network shows more family palatable? I think we're going to see a big collision here, and frankly, I'm going to enjoy covering every minute of it.
I want to talk about the January 14th hearing where senators actually, they didn't take responsibility. They didn't say, what have we wrought? But now they're saying, we got to stop this runaway train with regard to deregulation. And your description of the hearing was pretty funny. The right and the left are both complaining about media consolidation, and it seemed to drive you nuts. Why?
Well, having covered this, and there's a whole group of us in Washington who actually covered the original Telecom Act in 1996 and the debate on it in 95, we're called the Sparkheads. And, you know, we've lived through this. So the same people whom we saw standing up 6 and 7 years ago to demanding the rights of telecommunications company to buy anything and everything they want, all of a sudden they're standing up on January 14th and they're shedding these crocodile tears and wringing their hands over, oh my goodness, did you know that some radio owners now have 1,400 stations? Isn't that awful? And you're sitting there going, I'm sorry, what did you think was going to happen with the Telecom Act? Michael Powell, to his credit, didn't actually hit anyone. The chairman of the FCC very carefully said, you know, senators, this was what was ruled about in the Telecom Act that you yourselves voted on. Hint, hint. I think he should have stood up and said, you know, well, look, hey, it's got your initials on it. You take responsibility for it.
If you don't mind my asking you to prognosticate, I mean, you've been covering this stuff for a very long time. What do you really think will be accomplished this congressional session?
Well, accomplish is such a big word for anything coming out of Congress. What do I think will happen, as in accidents and things like that? I think that ultimately we will not see as much deregulation as the larger networks, larger radio conglomerates would like to see. I think we will see an end to that rule that keeps you from owning a broadcast station and a newspaper in the same town. But I think the rest of the caps, whether it's on network television ownership or cable ownership, I think they're really going to be more gradual than people have been predicting, and certainly more than Wall Street wants them to be.
Alicia Mundy, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Alicia Mundy is senior editor for Cable World magazine.
Last week, Radio 1 and Comcast announced plans for a new cable television channel targeted at African-American audiences. According to the Washington Post, Radio 1's CEO Alfred Liggins III wasn't the only player trying to put a deal together. Russell Simmons was interested, and so was Tim Reed. You may know Reed as Venus Flytrap from WKRP in Cincinnati, or more recently as the father on Sister Sister. He is an actor, writer, director, producer, and studio owner with a long list of credits and awards. Tim Reed joins me now on the phone from his home in Petersburg, Virginia, to discuss his commitment to diversity and quality in programming aimed at African Americans. Tim Reed, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, did you have any part in the Comcast Radio 1 deal?
Oh, we were aware of it, and we're certainly awaiting discussions when it gets to our point in our phase in interest, and that is in original content.
Well, what do you think of the deal as it's structured? In rough terms, Comcast has put up $70 million, and Radio 1 has put up $60 million.
Mm-hmm.
While they say they're not aiming to compete with black entertainment television, BET is the only African-American cable channel out there. Mm-hmm. How's it look to you?
Well, I think, as you said before, I'm certainly one of the many people who are interested in seeing another channel aimed at a different segment of the black population. You know, BET, what that channel is aimed at in terms of the audience is a younger demographics. It's more of a hip-hop culture. And I think it's missing an entire segment of the population that I hoped and what I've been trying and asking for is more attention paid to the black middle class and working class, people who are over 25 years of age, the people who give the money to the kids who go out and buy the hip-hop paraphernalia. There's very little entertainment aimed at them anywhere. Forget, you know, picking out just one channel, BET, but any channel. There's just very little aimed at them. And that's the audience that I think is neglected, and that's the audience that I'm interested in. That's why I came here and built a studio. That's why I've tried to create programming. And if you look at Frank's Place or Links, it certainly wasn't aimed at a lower level in terms of lower view of comedy or broad. It was aimed at a thinking kind of audience, someone who wanted to see their culture expressed in many different ways. So that's kind of why I'm excited about this possibility, and I like the targeted audience that the network has Alfred and Comcast have said that they're going for.
Well, BET has taken a lot of criticism over the years for the booty-shaking content and for its fixation on younger viewers and most recently for diminishing the amount of its broadcast aid that it devotes to news and public affairs programming. On the other hand, the entire world of marketing, the advertising community, is fixated only on the 15 to 24-year-old. If this network ever materializes, there will be a $130 million investment in it between Comcast and Radio One. Mm-hmm. Is it a good business plan to aim at exactly the target audience, 25 to 54-year-olds, that Madison Avenue has shown its disinclination to support?
Well, you know, these are the kind of questions that I think over the years have frustrated me, because was it a good investment to create Bravo? Was it a good investment to create the Biography Channel, the E-Entertainment? I mean, all these different channels that are aimed at demographics that's not as large as the massive audience always seem to be a good idea. These audiences are certainly smaller than the audience that we're talking about, but nobody seems to question that. Our Hispanic brothers have done extremely well. There are five nationally dedicated channels aimed at the 37 million audience that we talk about now as being now the largest minority. We're still 36 million or so in terms of the black population. We're not even talking about buying power in terms of dollars spent and loyalty to television viewership. We're larger than just about any segment based on our proportion of population. And yet whenever we talk about breaking our segment down beyond just the young hip-hop crowd, it seems to be ill-advised, or is there an audience? Of course there's an audience, just as much there's an audience for the Golf Channel or the Weather Channel.
I want to talk to you for a moment about ownership. I don't know if you saw the Washington Post story that quoted Jeffrey Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Mm-hmm. But in the story, he's quoted as saying that the deal is, quote, absolutely outrageous, mm-hmm. Because it denies African-American entrepreneurs the control of their own destiny. He's referring to the fact that Comcast, which has contributed slightly more than Radio One, the black-owned media company, that Comcast would retain business control over the combined concern. Does that trouble you?
To start a network in today's world takes quite a bit of money. You have to get that money from the business world, and people are not just going to put their money in and not want to have some say-so about how it's run. It's easy to sit back and criticize, but you got to step to the plate. Who in the world can do it? I mean, it takes hundreds of millions of dollars. So to belabor that point, I think, is such a waste of time that we should be focused on, you know, whether it's NBC or CBS or BET, decent programming that deals with the culture of its audience. That's missing. And I think that's where the argument should be.
Tim Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Reed is an actor, director, producer, and studio head. He joined me from his home and studios in Petersburg, Virginia.
Coming up, one town's grisly murder seen in black and white, and foreign cinema's uphill climb.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the PBS series POV aired the documentary called Two Towns of Jasper. Also this week, ABC's Nightline ran a series of programs devoted to the film and the reaction in Jasper, Texas. In 1998, James Byrd Jr., a black man, was beaten and chained to a truck in Jasper. He was dragged for 3 miles until his body was torn apart. Two friends, two filmmakers, one black, one white, decided to collaborate on a film that would follow the trial of the three white men accused of the crime. One would film the reaction of the white Jasper, the other the black community. Later, through editing, they integrated both versions into a single film, one with an extraordinary degree of candor. Shortly after Two Towns of Jasper played at Sundance last year, we interviewed the two filmmakers, Whitney Dow and Marco Williams. Marco Williams, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Whitney Dow, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Did you two find yourself sometimes not on common ground in editing the film?
It was an exceedingly difficult process because we didn't review each other's footage for the entire year that we shot. So I never saw what he shot. He never saw what I shot. We would talk periodically, and if I happened to be going by his hotel room, I might see a couple of frames that he shot, but we didn't view the stuff.
That's amazing. Why did you make that choice?
Because we really wanted to give each other the opportunity to really immerse themselves in their own community and really find the story there without any advocacy from the other side, to say, really, to be able to come back and say, this is what I found. Once we completed shooting, we then worked independently of each other for 6 months with separate editors. By happenstance, I had a black editor, Marco had a white editor, and we cut scenes, sequences, ideas that showed what we had investigated, and then we presented that material to each other. So it was really 18 months before we even saw what each other was up to. Then we brought in a third editor and took those set of scenes, and together we started to build a narrative out of those scenes.
And what do you think you got that you wouldn't have gotten if the black director and cinematographer went to talk to white members of the community and the races were reversed on the other side? Give me an example.
There's a scene where a group of whites are sitting around the table and they're talking about why they use the word nigger.
You know, I'm amazed at how easily offended people have become. Well, I don't mind telling you, I was raised with the word nigger, but it had no negative connotation in my life.
They're all sort of agreeing with each other, sitting around the table. Yeah, I never thought it was wrong. I never thought it was wrong. So it's that type of thing. I think that with Marco in that situation, there's no way that they would have been as frank in their discussion of that word as they would with me there.
I think that the evidence of this approach being effective within the black community is somewhat more subtle. One scene is of Walter Diggles. He is the most prominent bureaucrat in the town. He's the head of an organization, a county organization, and he's on a driving range.
Yeah, man, that's a good hitting ball. There's still a problem in this country with the perception of blacks that you and I are not going to be able to just erase, because we can't control the heart of somebody else. We can't change a white man's heart.
On first blush, you'd say he's talking, if he was talking across race, he's talking about we as black people. But in fact, he's really saying we, myself, Jonathan, the cameraman, both black men there. You know what, Marco, we can't tell what's in a white person's heart.
Is there a scene where both of you agree, God, we just nailed that. We could not have gotten it any other way?
The confrontation between Ethel Parks and Lewis Berry on the courthouse lawn during the third trial, where this is the only time in the course of the entire film where black and white face off with each other. The white crew is on one side filming their white character and the black crew is on the other side filming their black character. That allows us to intercut it seamlessly like a fiction film.
The tattoos.
That was a symbol that he didn't like black people, right. Those tattoos.
The tattoos were bad. We don't agree with them.
I have a lot of pity for him. But do you realize if he don't get the death penalty, he goes to prison.
He's going
to
die.
He's going to die anyway, or he's going to be tortured. Do you realize this?
I do realize this.
I'm still not clear on how your two intentions collided.
Let me give you an example. You're cutting a sequence on, you know, any subject. Is the first scene in that sequence with a black person? Is the last one with a white person? Who sets the agenda for the sequence? Who seems to be the driving force? Editing is a very subjective process.
How did your relationship change? Did it bring you closer or further apart?
How deeply we are divided by our cultures was not apparent to me before we started the project. And I think that I recognize now that the gulf that divides us, because simply growing up as a white American, him growing up as a black American, is much greater than I thought and not necessarily bridgeable in my mind.
Marco?
I don't think I entered into this with this naivete or of optimism that, you know, we shall overcome. But I did feel profoundly disturbed by how deep the chasm of our racial experiences are, and that friendship alone doesn't bridge it. There's much more needed to really get to an understanding, which I think is the positive of what Whitney and I went through. We essentially had to roll up our sleeves and confront the racial divide on a daily basis.
What one is left with after seeing the film is the sense that things have changed, but they can never really be resolved.
Yes, things have changed, but they aren't resolved. But there's the potential for individual change within all of us, and that to look for wholesale sea change is perhaps not where we should be looking.
Marco?
In my view, it's not enough for us just to see one individual white person change or another. It's that we want to see greater social change. I believe that for white people, it's much harder to understand the nature of the institutional racisms. And this is what I like about our film, and I think this is where we were quite successful, is that our respective viewpoints as filmmakers, our respective viewpoints as a black and white man, and the multifaceted viewpoints of a town are represented.
Thank you very much, Marco Williams.
Thank you very much.
And Whitney Dow, thanks to you.
Thank you very much for having us.
On Thursday, ABC's Nightline convened a town meeting in Jasper. Here's an exchange between host Ted Koppel and black business leader Walter Diggles, one of several, where Koppel tried to coax some candor out of a community still very much on the defensive.
You know, we in the media, we tend to sweep in and we suck all the marrow out of the bone, and then we get the hell out of town before we have had the chance to do the kind of National Geographic documentary that you'd like us to do. Right?
That's right. And Ted, I think
but
if you look
nevertheless,
at... Okay. All right.
Nevertheless.
Yes, sir.
There were some terrible things that happened here. You're telling me it was just an aberration? Is that what you're saying?
I think the people who did the crime were not reflective of the community as a whole.
The AP reports that some local officials debated whether to attend Nightline's town hall meeting, fearing a backlash from residents who have grown tired of seeing their political and religious leaders on TV. Said former district attorney Guy James Gray, "There are a lot of people out here who think, well, if y'all wouldn't talk, there wouldn't be a show and it would go away." And he added, "I don't think it's ever going away." Two Towns of Jasper has not been released nationally, but can be seen through March in a few cities. For screening dates and locations, go to our website at onthemedia.org.
Foreign language films like Talk to Her and Y Tu Mama Tambien showed up on several Best Movies of 2002 lists, but critical acclaim does not mean that foreign imports are pulling in the big American bucks. There was a time when it did. Back in the mid-70s, one study found that foreign films took in more than 10% of U.S. movie receipts. But by the late 1990s, the foreign share of the American box office had fallen to a pitiful 0.5%. Film industry folks blame the decline on a number of factors, but there are hints that Americans may be taking notice of imports once again. OTM's Paul Ingalls reports.
Cine Mexicano, $1, one senor.
Maybe $14?
It's a drizzly early afternoon at the Madstone Theaters in San Diego, and filmgoers are lining up for screenings that include American independent fare like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Japanese animation, and a Spanish-language film called De La Calle. That's the one Alex Vega's here to see.
I like foreign films. Well, it's something different, you know, as opposed to the same Hollywood stuff, same old thing. I like, you know, different stories from different parts of the world.
Stuff like the Werner Herzog, Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Ich bin der Zorn Gottes. Die Erde, über die ich gehe, sieht mich und bebt.
I mean, I still remember feeling like I had been, you know, tied to my chair, and I had to remind myself to breathe watching that movie. It had so much impact.
That's Carol Skinner, who remembers the hip foreign film scene of the late 60s and early 70s, her first exposure to masters like Herzog, Fellini, Truffaut, and Bergman. Back then, you'd see a challenging foreign film in a college class or at the local art house theater. then head off to a favorite watering hole to rap about it for hours. In the early 80s, Skinner packed her passion for foreign films and moved from Seattle to Idaho.
When I first moved to Boise, the only thing you could see at the movie theater was the Raiders of the Lost Ark. I used to tease people and say, you know, the reason that people in Boise don't like foreign films is because their lips get tired. And so I didn't have a very high opinion of people that weren't willing to go to foreign films and read subtitles because it really isn't hard.
On a blind date, Carol met a movie-loving architect who just happened to have blueprints for an art house theater in the trunk of his car. The two married and opened up Flix Theater and are still in business after 18 sometimes tough years. According to film industry folks, others of their generation are driving a new surge of interest in foreign films.
The baby boomers are now at a point where they become empty nesters.
Tom Gruenberg is co-CEO of Madstone Films, the owners of the San Diego Cineplex, and more screens in six other states.
Their children are now 16 or 17, and they're on their own, and for the first time in 12 years or 15 years, the parents have an opportunity to go out to the movies, and they don't want to see the Batmans, they don't want to see the Spider-Man, so they want to see films that kind of draw their interest, and those are either independent films or foreign films.
Gruenberg says this boomer return to theaters is beginning to reverse the slide in interest and availability of foreign films on U.S. screens that started in the mid to late 1970s. That's when the American blockbuster film arrived in full force. Jaws, Star Wars, Close Encounters. And in place of foreign directors, young American filmmakers like Scorsese, Cassavetes, and Coppola started making the kinds of edgy, thought-provoking films that used to only come from overseas.
Well, I promised each of the subjects that no one would see the videotapes except for me.
What are the interviews about?
The interviews are about sex.
In 1989, Sex, Lies, and Videotape was screened by then 26-year-old American Steve Soderbergh at the Sundance Film Festival. Critical raves and backing from Miramax Films helped Sex, Lies, and Videotape gross over 20 times the $1.2 million it cost to make. It was a landmark as studios started promoting American independent features more aggressively. Theaters then, given a choice between a small American film with an ad budget and a foreign title without, more often went American. Emily Russo, co-president of distributor Zeitgeist Films, says the foreign filmmakers couldn't adapt.
The foreign sales agents and producers of those films had certain kinds of expectations about what foreign films could do in the United States based on perhaps, you know, the history of what they had been doing in the 70s and early 80s. And the price tags on those films, so to speak, were rather high and not realistic for what the market could bear. So I think a lot of distributors sort of shied away from being able to acquire those films.
Meanwhile, on the theater end, the 80s and 90s were tough on the art houses and smaller cineplexes, and some shut down, particularly after the mainstream theater chains started a building boom. The new megaplexes were bigger and shinier, their stadium seats, picture, and sound all superior to the funky old movie houses where foreign films played. Jeff Anderson, film critic of the San Francisco Examiner.
I think the original idea behind multiplex is if you have a thing, a big, giant movie theater with 16, 25 screens on it, they could play, you know, five or six or seven or eight foreign films and then a bunch of other Hollywood films. But what they did instead was they have Harry Potter playing on, you know, 9, 10 screens and then, you know, other Hollywood films filling up the rest of the thing. So that failed.
Despite being ignored by most big theater chains and drowned out by American media buzz over its own independent filmmakers, foreign film retained a pulse in the U.S. A few foreign releases even managed to break through to larger audiences, like Water for Chocolate in 1992, Roberto Benigni's Life is Beautiful in 1997, and in 2000, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. In the case of Crouching Tiger, many were drawn into the theater by word of the stunning martial arts sequences. But once in, those who were new to foreign films learned that reading subtitles wasn't so bad.
And subtitles have actually gotten better and better over the years.
Carol Skinner of Boise's Flix Theaters.
You know, when I first started watching foreign films, people would talk for 5 minutes and you know, the subtitle would say something like, "Yes, I think so too," and you know that you missed something.
Ist das blutig genug so?
Although subtitles load the bottom third of the screen in this scene from 2002's Mostly Martha, you don't need them to know the lead character, a high-strung German restaurant chef, is, well, upset with her customers. The film reached a broader audience thanks to creative promotion by its distributor, Paramount Classics. Its co-president, David Dinnerstein, says a key factor was getting the food press to write about Mostly Martha.
We were able to start to screen the film for people that didn't necessarily like foreign films, but loved food. And once we got the film in front of them, they became huge, huge fans, and the word of mouth started to set in.
Paramount's Classics division is just over 4 years old, and in recent years, every Hollywood studio that didn't already have an in-house specialty division created one to promote independence and a few foreign titles each year. With the major studios more involved, specialty theater chains like Landmark and Madstone or local entrepreneurs are buying up some of those smaller movie plexes that had closed down in the 90s.
Two for Frida. And whatever your largest, biggest Diet Coke is.
I could just get a small cappuccino.
This 8-screen theater in Albuquerque was shut for years before Madstone bought it and reopened it.
Just wait over there by the coffee bar, your drink will be right out.
Now it has a coffee bar, a lounge where patrons can talk about their movies, and on this day it's showing two foreign language films. Albuquerque is like lots of other communities across the country that have also started holding annual film festivals, which include foreign movies. And the real fans know to hunt for other less obvious screens that carry the foreign titles that still can't get into the theaters. Emily Russo's Zeitgeist Films distributes some of those.
Because even when there are art theaters in those smaller communities, they're playing what they'll call art product, which is to us, you know, maybe the most commercial art films that are available, you know, films that are being distributed by the major companies. And therefore, for the type of product that we're handling, we have to really be very creative and innovative about trying to sneak into getting media centers or museums or even, to, in a sense, public libraries.
Other distributors and exhibitors we spoke with all say it's their intense love for good foreign cinema that keeps them motivated to get their titles seen, since, as Emily Russo says, these films are rarely big moneymakers. Still, there's always hope for a breakthrough title such as Amelie.
Bonjour, monsieur. Je vous appelle pour vous signaler qu'un de vos appareils est en panne.
The 2001 French romance proved irresistible even to foreign film skeptics, and it grossed over $30 million in the U.S., another $100 million worldwide. The possibility of returns like this and that passion for the genre among marketers and fans means that other subtitled gems are much more likely to be coming to a theater near you. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Coming up, mowing down AstroTurf in America's newspapers. And does the sports media protest too much?
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you read your local letters to the editor regularly, you may have seen this heartfelt letter praising the president. It begins with this sentence: "When it comes to the economy, President Bush is demonstrating genuine leadership." And it continues with this: "Contrary to the class warfare rhetoric attacking the president's plan, the proposal helps everyone who pays taxes." Over the last month, the same letter signed by different people has appeared in newspapers across the country. It's been dubbed AstroTurf, something that has the appearance of grassroots sentiment that's actually been manufactured by an interest group. Declan McCullough, chief political correspondent for CNetsNews.com, is no stranger to AstroTurf. His website, polytechbot.com, explores the interplay between technology and politics. But McCullough can't claim credit for finding this latest example of AstroTurf. He says it was bloggers who grew suspicious, did a Google search with some key phrases from the letter, found them duplicated in letters to the editor coast to coast.
The letters were actually identical because they were generated by the Republican website. I found about a dozen or so on my own.
How is this different from a traditional mass letter-writing campaign? I mean, the fact is, form letters have been circulating and been sent to congresspeople from time immemorial. Is the big difference here the fact that these form letters are going to newspapers rather than to congressmen and women?
I think that's one big difference. The ACLU, for instance, I remember them being one of the first to set up a website that lets you email and fax members of Congress. It seemed to work pretty well. Whenever there was a big campaign going on, they'd fire it up, and maybe they had an effect. But somehow it seems different to me. Maybe it's because I'm part of the media, but it seems different when we're getting messages that we don't necessarily know are coming from a Republican Party email bot rather than individuals who are composing them themselves.
And what was really sad is that there are a number of papers, like the Detroit News, which published the almost identical letter merely a week apart and didn't seem to pick up on the similar phrasing even then.
There's no excuse for that. You can understand a paper being taken in by letters that seem real, but publishing the identical one, there's some institutional knowledge there that seems to be lacking.
Where does most AstroTurf come from, do you think, across the political spectrum?
I think this is a growth area, and it seems to be a nonpartisan one. The Republicans might be a little bit more adept at using the web, but the Democratic National Committee site has a way to email pre-written letters to members of Congress. Let me add one more thing, if you don't mind. What the Republicans are doing is a first step towards sort of electronic delegation of our email inboxes. Right now, you actually have to affirmatively click and say, yes, I want to send a message to my local newspapers. But you can imagine some technology in the future, the not-so-distant future, that has a Republican or Democratic or whatnot email bots. You configure it. You tell it your preferences. You go down a list of little checkboxes on their web form and say, these are the issues I care about. And then whenever an issue comes up in the media, whenever a vote is about to happen in Congress, then this intelligent email bot will send out messages, customized messages, that you can't even tell were generated by a computer. I talked to a programmer from one political party that asked to remain nameless, and what they're doing is they're generating customized letters. You, as one of their members, can check off whether you want something to be lighthearted. You want your letter to be angry or sarcastic or polite. And then it'll pick from a large library of stock paragraphs, arrange them intelligently, and then send that one out. And so it's going to become increasingly difficult for someone in the media or even on Capitol Hill to figure out that these are actually computer-generated messages.
Well, sooner or later, somebody will be able to track these letters to their sources, just as many people tracked the Bush letter to the Republican Party. And there's a term in advertising, TV advertising, called clutter. If you clutter up the political debate with a lot of phony spam letters from people who've merely checked a box and aren't pouring their hearts into these correspondences, then they'll cease to become significant. No one will pay attention to them anymore.
Your use of the word spam is absolutely correct, because you have the same problem of filtering out legitimate email that you actually want to pay attention to from the stuff that's trying to sell you Viagra or something less mentionable. It's the same thing here. How can you tell whether something is a legitimate message or not? Eventually, we might have to resort to the time-honored message of calling someone on the phone and quizzing them. Hey, is this actually what you thought? What do you mean by this wording in the second paragraph?
So this is yet another example of what we frequently say on this program, let the reader beware.
And that's right, and let the letters to the editor beware.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. You're quite welcome.
Declan McCullough is chief political correspondent for CNetsNews.com, and he lives and works in Washington, D.C.
We at On the Media get a lot of books for free, but you don't, because publishers want your money. But there's a brand new business model that posits the idea that you will pay for a book because you can get it for free, at least a certain kind of book, one with a title like Embedded Configurable Operating Systems. The book is part of a series that publisher Prentice Hall is making available for free on the Internet. If you'd rather curl up with your technical reading, you can pony up $50 for a hard copy at the bookstore, or you can just get a photocopy of it with the publisher's blessing. Sound like a strange business model for a major publisher? Well, it turns out that a similar model has been the modus operandi for years in the community that is the target audience for these books. It's called open source, whereby software geeks write their programs, share them, and benefit from the improvements made by other geeks. And Prentice Hall thinks that these folks have a thing or two to teach the publishing industry. Joining us to talk about the Bruce Perrin's open source series are Prentice Hall editor-in-chief Mark Taub and Bruce Perrin's the open source advocate for whom the series is named. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thank you.
Bruce Perrin, before we get to the book series, please explain to me the principle behind open sourcing in software and how developers are rewarded for their efforts.
The genesis of open source is with a guy named Richard Stallman, who did his work in the early 80s. And Stallman was frustrated because he had a printer and he could not fix the software in his printer. And he asked the people who made the software for a copy of the source code. And they said, no, it's proprietary, which was actually a new thing in the industry. Until then, software was all open source. One of the problems that we've had from the proprietary model, the one that Microsoft follows, is that it pretty much stops collaboration from people who would otherwise help you. So in the open source world, we say, we are going to share and share alike. We will give you our source code, any modifications to that. Please make them open source as well.
Okay, fine. Mark Taub, tell me how that communitarian model can possibly work in publishing.
You know, one of the things we're hoping for out of this series is that we will see the kind of collaboration around the intellectual property represented by these books as you see around the intellectual property represented by software. Now, once the electronic copies of the books are available, that's the point at which collaboration becomes a possibility.
Mark, you're selling these books for $50 a copy. Why would I, as a customer, spend $50 now if I can just download it for free in the spring?
We believe that this makes good business sense. We believe that making free electronic copies of the books available will allow people to literally test drive the book. If they determine that this book is likely to meet their needs, we believe a good number of these people are going to opt to go and buy the printed book because it's a whole lot easier to consume a book on paper than it is electronically.
If all goes well, actually, the open source aspect of this will just be an ongoing promotion for the hard copy version of the books.
But it also serves an editorial function. You know, our expectation is the collaborators will emerge over the internet, which will help the authors create better books. Better books sell better. Books that sell better generate more royalties for authors. So, you know, it could be a virtuous cycle.
And the other thing is, think of all the people whose books go out of print. This is something they've put a lot of their lives into. It hurts. I mean, they can't maintain the book. People can't get it anymore. These days, authors aren't even getting electronic rights from their publisher. For that kind of author, there's the option to continue the book either electronically or in print, and you don't need the cooperation of the publisher to do so. So this is very advantageous to the author.
I'm curious, back in the hoary old days of the beginnings of open sourcing, It seems to me that your fellow open sourcers were the sort of peripheral hacker types with the libertarian slants, the kind of people that they make fun of on The Simpsons. By teaming up with the world's largest publisher of technical books, who ultimately does have the profit motive, do you think you're going to be regarded in your community as some sort of sellout?
Oh, no. First of all, Karl Marx did not invent helping your neighbor. As far as my own community is concerned, they are very happy about this series because what this says is, here is a brick-and-mortar paper publisher. They call them Dead Tree Publishing. And these guys have got the open source thing. They've realized that they can still make money while putting out open source versions.
Mark Taub, Bruce Perens, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark Taub is an editor-in-chief at Prentice Hall. Bruce Perens is the author of the formative document of the open source movement. They are editors of the Bruce Perens open source series of computer books, the largest ever application of open source principles to mainstream publishing.
Thousands of members of the press have convened this week on San Diego for Super Bowl 37. By now, they have analyzed and reanalyzed every conceivable big story of the past year's National Football League season. That is, except one. On the Media's John Solomon explains.
I am a gay former NFL player.
With that disclosure on HBO's Real Sports in October, ex-defensive lineman Ezra Tuolo stunned the football world. Yet even more shocking were the comments of a member of the media, Tuolo's former teammate Sterling Sharp, who is now a prominent ESPN on-air personality. Sharp told HBO that had Tuolo come out while playing, his own teammates would have attempted to seriously injure him.
He would have been eaten alive, and he would have been hated for it. Had he come out on a Monday, with Wednesday, Thursday, Friday practices, he'd have never gotten to the other team. Ever.
Sharp also said he feared that had he played with an openly gay teammate, the public might think he, too, was gay.
Because now I got to answer questions that normally I'm not answering. Question my heart, question my ability. Do not question my machoism, so to speak, my sexuality.
Surprisingly, Sharp's media brethren didn't question him on any of his statements. They didn't ask, for example, if Sharp feels most players would jeopardize their chances to win by physically disabling a gay teammate. Or does Sharp really think that the public's perception of his sexuality has changed now that it is widely known he shared the locker room with a homosexual? New York Times columnist Robert Lipsyte says the media is cowardly when it comes to covering the issue of pro sports and homosexuality.
Sports writers stay away from the story because they know that it makes athletes very uncomfortable, makes coaches very uncomfortable, and they want to be able to come back into the locker room.
Lipsyte says it also touches a deep societal nerve about ideals of masculinity. A hard-nosed, 6'3", 310-pound defensive tackle who happens to be gay imperils long-held stereotypes.
What's it mean if a homosexual can be every bit as macho and tough and competent as a heterosexual? Well, then, you know, this immediately starts tearing at the very fabric of what we've been conditioned all these years. And that's very tough for a jock, and I think it's also tough for a lot of sports writers.
The media have given sports a pass when it comes to talking about gays in the workplace, largely because one of the workplaces in sports is a locker room. Early in the season, New York Giants rookie Jeremy Shockey told the Howard Stern Show he hoped there weren't any gays in the NFL, adding, "They're going to be in the shower with us and stuff, so I don't think that's going to work." Shockey quickly apologized, but again, the sports media showed little interest in asking him what he meant.
I would like to challenge the press to dig deeper and challenge their readers to think deeper.
Mike Haynes is the NFL's vice president of player and employee development. He knows this is not an easy topic for reporters or players, because he admits holding what he calls some unsophisticated views on gays during his 14-year pro football career.
I think the media has accepted what these guys are saying and just have written it as it's the truth. I would ask them, to, when they're talking to the players, to give an example of, I mean, what is it that they're concerned about?
Haynes says that the NFL has decided to add sensitivity training on homosexuality to its player development program. But he believes that the aggressiveness of the media in covering the issue will also play a role in how pro sports deals with it. Sacramento Bee columnist Milo Bryant is one journalist who says he will alter his approach in the future. When San Francisco 49ers running back Garrison Hurst told him in an interview, "I don't want any faggots on my team," Bryant says he should have followed up.
If I was to do something again, I would ask different questions. I would ask more probing questions. I guess probably questions that would make the athletes even more uncomfortable, because a lot of the players talk about another guy being in the shower, being in the locker room with you, them looking at you or this or that. And it's like, well, I'd want to see how many players have actually had that.
Most of the press have also gone along with the conventional wisdom that pro team sports are not ready for an openly gay player. That's partly because they've let the outspoken naysayers drive the discussion. It's reminiscent of much of the media's approach in the days before the sports color barrier was broken. Mike Haynes.
If you go back before they were letting black athletes play football, it's like, we'll never have a black guy on our team. I'll never eat with a black man. You know, they were saying the same things. And I think that this is another subject matter that is very similar, that in the end, the guys are going to realize, you know, it was nonsense that I had that attitude.
This summer, the New York Post printed a blind gossip item stating that a New York Mets player who, quote, spends a lot of time with pretty models and clubs is actually gay. In response to the tabloid feeding frenzy, Mets star Mike Piazza called a press conference to say, "I am not gay." Reporters played down Piazza's further contention that an openly homosexual player would not be a problem for baseball. Fans may agree. Late last year, an ESPN.com survey of 40,000 users found 78% felt that if their favorite player announced he was gay, it would not make a difference to them. Now that's a story. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Brian Tilley. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.